Kamala Mala asked me an interesting question in the forum, and although it's a kind of a question that you would rather, shall we say, avoid answering because it deals with subjects that one would rather avoid dealing with, it's interesting because these are subjects which actually one should not be afraid dealing with. It's kind of like when you have to talk about something unpleasant and you always want to avoid talking about it for fear of putting yourself in an unpleasant situation. But sometimes it's not as difficult as we make it out to be. I suppose death is like that too, or any particular situation in which we struggle or we think we will struggle very much, a situation of which we are very afraid, a situation which we feel has such incredible import and something which is permanent. It cannot be undone. It's not something you can move back from once you have gone there. I think from that point of view, a lot of the times, our fears of dealing with issues which may be related to our faith or related to everything that we value in life, these issues become very difficult to deal with. I have seen that people who have difficulties in their families, difficulties in their relationships, don't want to look at it. Don't want to see it for what it is. They're afraid to do so because they feel that were they to address these issues, it could lead them to a situation which would create a transformation which would be irrevocable, would send them down a pathway which would literally force them to be completely different, to change. Now, some people don't mind change. Me personally, I'm one of those people who don't really like changes. I'm the kind of a person who likes things not to change. Whatever is should always be. Now, of course, we know that's impossible. It's impossible that there'll be a situation in which things never change. We know that. Yet, we feel, I feel at least, that consistent, unchanging situations are the very basis of life. Other people have the same problem. For example, when they have to deal with problems in the body. I know people who have had strange lumps or strange symptoms in the body and who have refused to go to the doctor or have it examined or do tests about it because they're deathly afraid of what the result would be. They're deathly afraid that they may have cancer or they may have something which will cause or be responsible for an operation to take place where something has to be cut out or you lose something very valuable or your life may be in danger. And a lot of times by refusing to face the situation, people die. I know many people in that situation and a couple of people who have died because of their inability to face the very dangerous situation of not being bold enough or not being brave enough to accept what it is that's facing their lives. Now, I'm not saying this is because we're chicken or because we are less intelligent or because we don't care. This is human nature. Human nature is such that it discourages us from seeking out things which are transformatory. Now, that situation is not exactly so when we are a late teenager. You know, in the years 18, 19, 20, 21. At that time, we're moving away from home. We've been living in the nest for too long. And we feel that we've been there in the nest long enough. And now it's time to move from the nest and spread our wings and fly into the world. So at that time, this idea of transformation, the idea of moving out, the idea of change is not only attractive, but it's an essential biological, physiological, genealogical force. This is a force which is dictating to us that to propagate the species, reproduction, for the sake of the whole survival of the race, I have to go out, start a family, earn money, and expand the world. At that time, transformation is something which is not only important, but is something which is essential. It's essential because without it, one would lose something which was very, very basic, something which is very, very connected to what we are as people. Because if it's so essential that to lose it would cause us to become disconnected from what we are as a race, that not feeling this capacity to move away, to have this desire to transform, to have this desire to move forward, we would never be able to exist. How does this relate to spirituality? How does this fear that we have of dealing with fundamental things relate to us? Well, we can obviously see the connections. When we are young, we can understand how transformation, how moving into other or newer realms or things is not only important but essential, and therefore we can join spiritual groups. We can just drop everything and get a backpack and move off to India or Tibet. We can do all kinds of very fantastic moves in our lives. We don't have that fear. We can move forward and do things we would never consider doing when we're 60 or 50 or 40. This is because we have a power when we are young that we just don't have later on. That's why they take soldiers who are young, who haven't yet created a family, who haven't that much to lose. They think like that. They think that it's easier for them to die or to be wounded for life than anyone else. Of course, it's absurd, but this is the mentality behind it. Yet, when we move into a spiritual group or some spirituality at that age, we then go through the same process of creating roots as we would if we were in any other aspect of life. Those who are in some kind of like religious group, they are establishing roots in the same exact way that a normal person establishes roots. They are becoming attached to a service, or attached to an ashram, or attached to a position, or attached to the way in which they make money or manage money. They make roots. They try to develop things. This is there in every single religious group that one enters into voluntarily in one's youth. That same exact thing is there when you are a regular, quote-unquote, person. You're developing your living situation. You are developing what you do. You are developing your particular economic basis. So, in both situations, you are dealing with the exact same phenomena. Now, considering this, let's move back a few steps. And let's talk about this fear we have of addressing our foundation, of looking at those things we take for granted, looking at those things which we feel comfortable with, looking at those things which give us stability. And don't forget, these things have enormous power where we live, how we pay the bills, our family, our friends, our most intimate relationships. All of these have enormous power. These things define us. If anybody were to ask you, what are you? Who are you? You would reply in terms of these fundamental aspects of your life. You would reply in terms of what you do, where you live, how you live, about your family, about your associations and groups, about your religious beliefs, about your church or temple. I remember when I was in communication, we talked about this before, with those people who were in my high school, who I had been associated with when we were 5 years old, up until we were 17 or 16 when we graduated. Now, when we were discussing about us, how it is with us now, the discussions were totally connected to who I married, my children, the work I do, where I live or lived, and the history of how these things transformed. Well, my first husband was like this. My second husband was like that. My children from her first husband do this. My children from my second husband do that. I changed my work when I divorced my first husband. The whole life is described in terms of this foundation. Now, for a spiritualist, this is not necessarily very much different, except that, let's take the example of spiritualists who understand that, I'm not saying this is correct, I'm saying who understand that the body is illusory, it's only to be used in the service of God, and other than that, anything connected with the body is maya, unless it's used in the service of God. Illusion. Now, such people would not describe, if you had, let's say, for example, a devotee reunion after 30 years, you would never mention your different wives if you had any. You wouldn't speak about these things that everybody else speaks about. You would speak about your service. You would speak about your guru. You would speak about your deities. You would speak about your last trip to India. You would speak about your health because it's hindering your service. You get the point. You would talk about your chanting, whether it's good or not, or whether you're developing bhava or not, you would talk about a different set of values. Now, this is good. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just describing what it is. What's important here in this discussion is to understand the mechanisms by which we become attached to the foundations of our life. Fundamental things which give us stability. Now, all of us are immediately related to this reunion of devotees or reunion of people because we all have this experience. Doesn't matter whether we've been in a group or not, whether those of you who've listened, who are listening now used to be in a group or never were in a group, you can relate to the fact that those fundamental things which you consider most important are those things you talk about when you meet people after a long time. Now there's a whole other section of things which we are afraid to address. Back to health. I remember Rati Devi Dasi. She was together with me and her husband was, they were taking care of me for many, many years. This was an extraordinary woman, very powerful woman. She was a doctor, a homeopathic doctor, very qualified, very capable, very powerful person. Never was vague about anything she did. Of course, some people thought that was a defect. Anyway, I love that in her. So one day she had started to discover lumps here and there. And she was afraid to address it. So she didn't mention it. And I started noticing that she was becoming more stressed. But she never talked about it. Like she couldn't drive as much as she used to. She couldn't do what she did. And then when she did, she started getting all confused in her head and very upset. And I thought, this is strange. There's something wrong. This is not related to just her personality or even her gender. This is something different. And then one day, she finally got up enough courage to ask somebody about it. That person was supposed to have been a doctor. He didn't tell her right. He said, oh, just ignore it. But she knew because she was a doctor. But then too late, she went to the hospital. And they said, oh, you have cancer. And it caused her death. One of the saddest things that have ever happened to me, I must say. But besides that. So it was because of not wishing to address this fundamental thing, this axiomatic foundation of life, the body, that which everything is based on. And for a spiritualist, this body is very important, but that's not what I wanted to talk about today, because I wanted to talk about something which is, I would say, more important to a spiritualist who has convinced themselves that the body is also not important. That the body is simply maya, illusion, that we use for service. And if we die, no problem. We just go back to Godhead. Now, there are other axiomatic issues that we accept as the foundations of our lives when we are spiritualists. And that boils down to our belief system. What it is we believe. Now, when we are already in such a system, in other words, when we have already accepted the system, the structure, we don't question this anymore. The structure, the belief system, the values surrounding it, the fundamental truth of it, the absolute truth of it, the eternal, unending, never-changing truth of it is never questioned. You may question a few things. For example, you may question a detail, philosophical details. And one can argue for months about a small philosophical detail, which in everybody's minds, especially those who are debating, has enormous repercussions philosophically. Now, if you look at it from outside, people go, certainly you must be kidding, this is not very serious. But when you are in such a thing, it's very serious. Now, when you are young or when you enter into this transformed situation, and this can be done even when you're older, when circumstances in your life have dissolved, that which you valued has dissolved enough, and your curiosity, your need for something else has come to such a point that it draws you towards some spiritual organization or some form of spirituality, which we think can only be attained in an organization, rightly or wrongly. None of this is with value here. We move in that direction. So now, as we are moving into that direction, we are new to it. And it's better that you don't know much, because it's a lot easier to learn fresh than to change that which you already know. Re-educating somebody is much more difficult than educating somebody. Because when you educate somebody, you simply say, it's like this. When you re-educate somebody, you have to say, it's like this, and it's not like that because. So you practically have to undo X amount of years of education to make sense for that person who already has some other idea. Transforming in that way, changing the person's ideas is difficult, but it happens. Those who are enthusiastic to change, they do it. And then they're moving into this direction because they feel it's something they should do. They feel it's giving them a new perspective of life. They feel it's leading them towards something very important in their lives. They feel they're going to attain something they really want to, they really need. Because we have spiritual needs. We have needs. We need to feel that spirituality. We need to know that when we die, we're going to go to some form of heaven or beyond. We need to feel secure that there is some force in the universe who's watching over us, who is going to save us when we are in difficulty, who we can turn to like a father, who will actually solve all these problems that we have in our lives somehow or another. We need this. And therefore we accept a philosophical structure, complete with culture, complete with history, which can give us that, all that we need. And therefore, after we have accepted this fully, challenging that concept at its fundamental level is as difficult as dealing with fundamental challenges for anybody anywhere in the world. For a person who doesn't want to face the challenge of a lump under the arm. For the person who doesn't want to face the challenge of a marriage that seems to not make sense anymore. For a person who has to face the challenge that all that they are doing economically is going to get them nowhere. For the person who faces the challenge of anything that addresses their fundamental stability. It is the same. Anything that challenges our fundamental stability goes into this category of something we do not like to address. Unless we are very bold, very honest, and also have a lot of faith in ourselves. It takes an incredible amount of faith in yourself to address these things. And that faith says, no matter what, I will be able to deal with life because I want to do everything according to what is right, what is true for me, what actually is proper. And when you have such faith, you then can make this incredibly bold move of addressing fundamental stability. Now, spiritually speaking, that challenge is very, very difficult. Because after all, you have a belief system. Sometimes it's called a faith. We even in English speak of what faith do you belong to? That's very interesting. What faith do you belong to? Faith. A religion could be called a faith. They sometimes don't ask what religion. They say, what faith do you profess? What faith do you belong to? Now, okay, I understand that once you are very deeply into a religious tradition, for you it is less a question of faith and belief and more a question of just learning how it all works, because it's absolutely correct and there is absolutely no need to challenge that. You just accept it. Now in your mind you think, I don't have belief. It is this way. And I'm accepting it. I have simply understood it. Because this is the way it is. Now those who live outside of your belief look in and say, no, it's your faith. It's what you believe. Because it could be some other way. Those who are inside the faith look out and say, you just don't know. You are in ignorance. You are in Maya. Or you are a demon who is trying to destroy the foundation of our believers' existence. You are a demon who's trying to kill devotees. Because as devotee, we are devoted to this, to God. Now, sometimes it's interesting because even those who are considered demons may believe in God. Goodness. Let's maybe put that aside for now. Now, this is a very big point, so forgive me if I'm struggling to present it conceptually in the proper chronology. Now again, back to that fear we have. Again, it's a fundamental fear of challenging axiomatic truths upon which all of our stability rests. Now spiritually, that would mean challenging all we have learned. I'm not saying all that we believe. I'm saying all that we have learned. Because we believe that all that we have learned is something we need. Now just consider this. You're in a group and you want to go back to heaven, back to Godhead, back to Vaikuntha, back to wherever it is you go when you've been good and you die. Now, considering that's our number one need, salvation, redemption, liberation, or the number one need to be accepted by God. Even if we think salvation and liberation is not the highest, we just want to serve. Still, the idea is to enter into the pastimes of Radha and Krishna. And if we can do that, it doesn't matter where we would do it, but we would still be there. Kind of a contradiction, kind of a philosophical flip in the head, but it doesn't matter. The idea is to somehow become so proper in the eyes of Radha and Krishna that we enter into their realm. And we are there, and it doesn't matter where we are some other time, we are there. That's where we want to be, because we've got this need to get there. If we are less philosophically evolved or have some other religion, that place is heaven, and everybody has wings and angels, and they fly. Or if you are of the Islamic faith, you go to heaven after you blow up a lot of Israelis, and you can have sex with 21 virgins or 54 virgins or whatever number of virgins there are. Of course, one wonders where those virgins came from and what they do with those virgins after they're no longer virgins. But that's another issue. Heaven is a very special place, and everything can be arranged in heaven. Even virgins can come and go without any problem there. We don't worry about the virgins because, after all, they're women. Now, all these ideas are based in needs. You may call them desires. You may call them aspirations. You may call them ultimate situations. They are needs. That's what drives us to these goals. I need this. I need to do these things, and I have to do all these things because I need to get there. So for those who have such needs, the concept of the very dangerous concept of questioning the fundamental axiomatic truth is not acceptable. Just as when we are very attached to our body, addressing the lump under the armpit. That's what Rati had, by the way, in the lymph system. Unacceptable. We'll just kind of ignore it. We'll just kind of hope it goes away. Now, what is it that we would address if we were to do it? Well, we would address, well, why do we believe the way we believe? Or even if we took it a step back, all that stuff we learned, is it really so? All that stuff, all of it, every bit of it, is it so? Now, can you imagine addressing that? That's like addressing when you have a marriage and you're starting to see certain things and you think, address, and it's very stable for you. Your whole life is very stable. And then you have to look at it and you say, is it so? Is it really so? Do you know what kind of courage that takes? Especially, let's say, you're the lady of the house and you're economically dependent on your husband. And then you have to look at your marriage and say, is it really so? You have to have such faith in yourself that you'll have such faith that you'll think, no matter what, I will be able to take care of myself. But what if you have children? What if you have many children? You are not capable, from the economic stability and foundation point of view, of addressing, is it so? It becomes horrifying. Even if you do in your mind somewhere, immediately the mind says, this is the way the mind works. God, look at this. here this bum of a husband is coming home again at 1 a.m, drunk, stinking of perfume and cigarette smoke. Obviously, something's going on here. But I got 8 children. I am 40 years old. Now, is that possible? I guess so. I can't take care of everything. I need this situation. The mind says, maybe he had a business meeting. Maybe he went to a after dinner show. I don't care. I just can't deal with it. Now, believe me, this happens more than anyone would like to admit. You can make various transformations of this scenario, difference of age, switch husband with wife, more or less children, whatever you want. But you get the point. Now, let's put us into a spiritual group. And again, it doesn't matter which spiritual group. Our economy is based in it. We eat, we sleep, we are sheltered, we have friends, even relatives, association, something to do. That's a big one. A valuable part to play. To think about losing these things, it puts you in the same situation. So to be able to question the fundamentals of it. Often you think with a doubt, but really, is the earth flat? Really, are these oceans there? Did that king actually have 100 million barren wives? Am I actually going to go to hell if I don't wear tilak? Etc. Is every single word from the mouth of my guru absolute? What about from someone else's guru? Now that disciple's got the absolute. And if they don't take it absolutely from their guru, they don't get what they need. But I don't think what that guru said was right. What does that mean? Well, just think about that. That guru said like this, I don't think it's right. That disciple accepts it fully and argues with me because they need to have that to fulfill their role, to fulfill what they need. So obviously the only conclusion is my guru is better than your guru. Your guru doesn't know as much as mine because I can't address these essential things which attack the foundation of my existence because I need to get to that place where I herd millions of cows, which are all different colors, which all have their names. And when I call their names, they come. And they give unlimited amounts of milk. And we milk all these cows. And we have so much milk everywhere. And so much ghee. And so much butter and yogurt. And we must be fat as 20 pigs because we are eating day and night all of this stuff that we are making from these hundreds of millions and billions of cows. But we're not fat. Because if we would become fat, we wouldn't look good. And if we don't look good, Krishna wouldn't like us. And Radha would be upset with us because Krishna wouldn't like us. But if Krishna would like us, Radha would become slightly jealous, maybe even very jealous. So we have to not be too good and pay attention. So we must have this metabolism where we can eat millions of globjamins and never get diabetes and never get fat and never get hardening of the arteries and therefore no heart attacks, high cholesterol, because our spiritual bodies burn all this up instantly. Of course, we don't have to eat even because of the same reason. Food is not necessary because we don't need to eat because of the special bodies we have that don't require food for maintenance. And therefore, we don't even need cows because we don't need food. And even if we eat a lot, we don't poop or pee because our bodies just burn it all up. It disappears. Now, we don't need any of these things, but we do them because it's fun. But why do we have to have fun like that? We're full of fun. We're full of bliss. It's inconceivable. It's the spiritual realm. Don't place your nose that's material in the spiritual realm and try to put material rationality on it. It simply is. Just like those 100 million wives that are barren. There are many things. I'm not going to get into each and every one of these things. What I am doing is just taking a few steps into questioning. Now, when I would go further and further and further and question and pick out things little by little and take them out of context, any sane person would smile and would say, gee, that sounds funny. But let's take it in context for a second. Let's put it all back into context. What is that context? Okay, well, that context is plain and simple. I need this. I need this. Because this is what I need. This is where I'm going. Because I can't stand it here. Talk to anybody who has this feeling. You will see universally, this world is a horrible, horrible place of suffering. It is bad. But if you think this is bad, ho-ho, just you wait. Because if you do wrong things, there are hells waiting for you, which are so bad that you could distill all the badness in this world into concentrated badness. Multiply that by 1,000, by 1,000,000, and you will approach the badness of these hells. In one of these hells, you are brought to the top of a mountain, thrown off, and the sharp rocks cut you up into tiny little pieces. And you are conscious the whole time that you are being destroyed in this way. The pain is inconceivable. Then these characters, who actually have a great time doing this, yet they're not demons. They are characters who love to torture you because it's their service to do so. But they are not demons. Demons are much worse. And these characters go down the hill and they pick you up and put you back together again, carry you back up the hill, and throw you off again. And it repeats like this forever. Oh my God, I better not do that. That is bad. This world is bad. Why is this world bad? Because this world is filled with all of those things which can allure me, which can seduce me into acting in such a way that I will be a candidate for all these bad things to happen, for all these hells, for my eternal damnation, to burn in hell for eternity because I committed sin, because I turned from God, because I turned from what is absolute. Now just think about this. This is accepted. And therefore, when you accept this, you need to be good. And how do you be good? By following all the things you have learned. Avoiding all the things you've learned to avoid. Because if you don't, you are bad. And if you are bad, you go to hell. Or if you don't go to hell, if somehow or another you manage to avoid hell, if somehow or another you're rising above the waters of hell, you're just going to get really bad karma. And next lifetime, you're going to be born in a really lousy situation, painful, screwed up. And you don't want that either. So you've got to be good. You've got to do everything fine. Because you need to get to that place where there's no more suffering like this. Where there's no more pain like this. Because there's this world of pain, and there's those places where there's no pain. And one doesn't even want to go to heavenly places, because even though there's no pain, and it's pretty good there, and you'll have a good time, you're going to have to come back here and get stuck again in all this pain with the worry about going to hell. So that's no solution either. And how do you know you've got to come back? Because that's what you learned. So to prevent you from being interested in any of these devas up there, the idea is that the reason why it's no good to be there is because you have to come back. And when you have to come back, you have to be stuck again. So therefore, you're told not to be involved with any of these devas. Because if you worship them, the problem will be is that you may have to go to their places when you die. And then when you go to their places, you're going to have to come back here again and get stuck again and be seduced again and maybe have to go to hell. Therefore, there's only one thing to do. Go back to Godhead. Now, you've learned this. We have all learned this. And it fulfills our needs very well. Why? Because we have experience. This world is potentially a really lousy place. You know, you get physical problems, you get mental problems, you get emotional problems, your friends get problems, your family get problems, your economics get problems, there's death, there's war, there's disease, there's old age. These things do exist. I don't like these things. Therefore, I agree with all this. I accept that I have my need to get out of all this. I accept the need to transform everything. And I know the only way to do this is with somebody who's already done it. And how do I know they've done it? It's what I've learned. Because I accepted entrance into this educational institution. This religion is an educational institution that's educating me. I've accepted it. It has accepted me. Do you understand the problem? It's easy for me to sit here and tear apart any religion. It's not difficult. Every religion, even if it thinks it's the most sophisticated one, with the most sophisticated philosophy, with the most sophisticated system of understanding, every single religion is easy to pick apart. You simply have to study it a little. You'll find absurdities everywhere. You lift up a few rugs, you'll find that which they've swept underneath. You'll find defects in the way people act within the religion. You'll find absurdities amongst gurus in every religion, bishops, popes, priests, imams, whatever. You'll find absurdities amongst followers. You'll find all that. You'll find hypocrisy. You'll find outright sinfulness. You'll find abuse of especially women. You'll find abuse of children. It's there everywhere. It's easy to see it. You don't have to be very smart to see it. My particular unique presentation is that I make it funny. When I say it, you laugh because it's funny. But it's not difficult to do this. And it's not that because I can do this, that means I know something more or this is something special. It's actually not very important. What's important is to understand why I need. And once we understand why I need and what it is that I really need, to then go back and examine these structures and to accept these structures for that which can give me good and reject that which has no value. I'll tell you what I need. I assume many of you will relate to this. I don't know. But what I'm really sure of is what I need, because I know very well what I need. I need to feel part of something. I need to feel that my part has value. I need to feel that my life enables me to be of service to others. I need to feel that my life is more than just eating and sleeping and cleaning the house. I need to feel that I am connected with those beings who are of, shall we say, closer to transcendence, closer to the realms of transcendence, who have these enormous capacities, who have greater capacities, who can connect with me through the etheric wave frequencies, who I can communicate with, who can help me find my way through this maze of choices, who can guide me in the proper direction. When I'm lost, who can help me move in the right way. When I doubt, who can help me find out how to resolve. Who can help answer my questions. Who can warn me when there's something I need to be aware of. Who I can feel love from. Who I can love unconditionally. Who love me no matter what I do. Who love me for what I am, not what I present myself to be. And who I love for what they are. And that I will be so connected with them as I walk through this world. I will be on this platform and yet within another realm at the same time, right here, right now. So that my right here, right now, has such a power to it that when I do something for others, when I am of service in this world, when I am caring, when I am loving, when I have this interaction now, it will have meaning to me. My life will have meaning. I need this. I can't live without this. I've always been like this, just the way I am. I'm sure you relate very well. It is the nature of the spirit to feel like this. Now, if we know the bare, naked nature of the essence that we are, we will be able to address fundamental issues, fundamental stability in a totally different way than somebody who has bought totally and completely everything about a particular cultural religion. Now I'm going to tell you something else about what I believe. You know, it's belief, isn't it? If you think about visualization, you all, every one of you, have had the experience of creating a reality in your room that is completely beyond this world. You created it. Okay, we all did it together. There's more power in a group. When the group all feeds a reality etherically with their energy, it becomes very powerful. That's why groups exist. Everybody has a similar belief. They feed that which they are creating. They give it power. They empower their guru. They empower everything about their culture, their philosophy. That's not bad. That's just the way it works. Systematically. Systematically, we create these realities because we need to. There's nothing wrong with this need. It is just what we need. It is a reflection of what we are, because we are one, a group. All of us together are a group. Okay, maybe it's practically infinite. I don't care. But it is a group. It's a group called everything. We feel comfortable as being an integrated, accepted, acknowledged, loved part of that group. So when we get together here, the Harry Media TV people, and we create a group, and we go into a meditation, and we do visualizations, we create reality. Somebody may say it's your imagination. Somebody may say it's your belief. Who cares? It works. Because when you are on that level, what you believe, what you visualize, is what is. That is the fundamental principle upon which all heaven is established. I will repeat that. The fundamental principle upon which all heaven is established is our empowering visualization of it. So the Christians go to the Christian heaven. If they visualize themselves as very bad and needing to burn in hell, they'll visualize that. Does that mean all the cows? All the cows. What about the cows? Where are they part of that too? Well, it will be told. No. It's already there. You are invited into it. You don't create it. It invites you in. Okay. What does that mean? That means you believe it. It's your heaven. Let's follow this very carefully. It's your heaven. You need it. You want to get there. You need to be invited. To get the invitation, you have to believe it with every microcosmic, atomic, subatomic, energetic particle of your being, with no doubt. You have to accept it so much that you'll do everything to get there. And when you're ready, you'll stumble onto books, let's say, of Bhaktivinoda, like Manashiksha. And you will discover the Astakalya, or whatever it's called, Lila. Astaka Kali Alila, you'll discover it. The eight parts of the day, you'll meditate on it with your mind. You'll visualize it. You'll totally absorb every bit of your energy into it. Because you're doing so, you will enter into it because you will be invited in. Your guru will invite you in. Because at this point, your previous guru, if he, it must be a he, is not connected to it, you can't get in it. Because the guru, what he does is he puts in your mind that visualization of it. And when you've got that visualization there and you're empowered with it, it is the invitation that lifts you into it. Now, although that scenario is very sophisticated, it is a very, very sophisticated form of spiritual visualization. It is just a spiritual visualization. It's nothing else. You have empowered the image. You have connected yourself with the image. You have bought into the image. Again, I'm not saying that's bad. You need it. I love Radha and Krishna. I also love Lord Chaitanya, but to a certain extent, he frightens me. Honestly speaking, he frightens me because of certain things that I was supposed to believe about him. And it's hard for me to get it out of my mind. But I love Radha and Krishna. I also love Shiva and Parvati, Lord Shiva, Goddess Parvati. I love their family. I have problems. I wouldn't even mind going there and staying there. I wouldn't have a problem. You lost me. I said, I love Lord Shiva, Goddess Parvati. I wouldn't have a problem going there and living there in Kailash. Honestly. I love Radha and Krishna. I wouldn't have a problem going and living wherever they are. Honestly. I would have a problem, though, being surrounded by millions of cows. I would have a problem with having to milk those cows. I would have a problem with most of the stuff. Because I don't come from a village. You see, my perfection of stability is not to have unlimited milk and unlimited grains. Because for some reason or another, I don't drink milk. I'm a vegan. And I don't eat grains. I don't take wheat. So for me, the concept of my stability and my foundation of life doesn't get inspired by lots of milk and lots of grains, neither of which I eat. So when I think about the fact of having to go to that place and having to work, you know, quite a lot to milk cows, to drink milk, doesn't inspire me. Maybe 5,000 years ago or whatever it was, it would have inspired me a lot. Maybe in my time when I was living in this village and everything depended on the land and the cow, I would have thought, hey, unlimited milk, unlimited grains, that's heaven. You have a cow that you milk it and, you know, doesn't even have to eat grass. I just keep milking it. I get all the milk I want. Hey, that's heaven. And all these girls are carrying yogurt across the Jamuna. Hey, that's like heaven. Well, I don't think like that now. I mean, now I'm not sure what my heaven would look like. I mean, I don't feel like having to go back and reinvent the wheel. What is my heaven? So when I'm in this realm, I do go to my realm. I don't have to be ashamed to mention it because you go there too when I go there. But besides that. So when I'm in my realm, I'm just happy with the interactions. I'm happy with the way it feels to be together with everybody. And I just like that feeling. And sometimes I do things too. Sometimes I do a lot of things. I don't need them to be in a certain context. I just like them to be whatever they are. I like it that Radha and Krishna are in whatever context they wish to be with me. And the amazing thing is that they are in the context with me now, here, in this kind of a situation. Okay, in my heaven there's no TV. There are no computers. There's no internet. There's no internet. Can you imagine? In my heaven. Now, if I had to, let's say I was going to make a religion. Let's say I was going to give my heaven in a way which other people can also visualize that heaven and empower it. Well, I would have to start coming up with something which culturally and historically was making sense here and now. My modern religion would be, okay, the weather would have to be heavenly. Just like yesterday, I was walking Suchi in the forest, and I was thinking that, if somebody were to ask me about the weather here right now, I would say, well, it's near enough to heavenly. If I were to ever conceive of weather in heaven, it would be very close to what it is right now. And there would be beautiful forests and trees and gardens. And there would be oceans to swim in and feel the breeze from. My heaven wouldn't be in the middle of a continent. And I wouldn't have to have a river to take a bath in. I'd have a nice shower, which I could use anytime I wanted. And my heaven, I wouldn't have to worry about cows. I don't really need cows in my heaven. I don't need bulls in my heaven. There may be some horses because people I love like horses. And there would definitely be some cool cats and dogs and birds, lots of birds, and fishes here and there and all kinds of creatures, beautiful butterflies. And there'd be streams, if I want to go to one, and waterfalls. And there would be beautiful transitions from day to night. The sun would not have ultraviolet or infrared. It would just be very beautiful, peaceful. Maybe I'd have multiple suns to avoid shadows, but looking into my sun would not hurt your eyes. At night, there would be beautiful stars, beautiful show in the heavens that I could just lay down and see these shows, and they would be always changing. Beautiful shows in my heaven. But the night wouldn't be so long. And when I slept, I would have beautiful dreams, which would be very, very peaceful, relaxing. To go off to another place, mind you. Because even in heaven, you want to avoid it getting too boring. So you sometimes have to go off to another place. In your dreams, I mean, after all, there's night. Of course, in certain persons' conceptions of night, things go on all night long. And only certain persons sleep. You see, Maharaj Nanda and Mother Yashoda, they sleep. But the Krishna and the gopis, they're not sleeping. They're just going at it all night long. So in my heaven, you can have it either way, as you like. In my heaven, you can make everything as you like. You can have everything as you like. If you want to do stuff in my heaven, you can have, like, say, a football match. Or you could, I don't know, whatever you want to do, you can do it. Just have fun up there. And you should be able to go on vacation just to get away from it all. But if I were to make a heaven, I would have to make it very descriptive. Descriptive. I would have to describe it in such a way that other people would say, wow, is that what heaven is like? I want to go there. Then I would say, well, if you want to go there, you have to become qualified. And to be qualified, you have to come in contact with yourself, your essence, and be in contact with all of that beautiful energy which is around you, and visualize yourself in that situation. Visualize yourself in contact with those who are already there. And the way you can do that is by always being desiring to be of service. I would create a whole religion. My religion would probably become very popular because I wouldn't have like rules that say you can't have illicit sex, or that, you know, there wouldn't be any intoxication or gambling or regulating what you eat, because I would know that rules somehow make things complex. We wouldn't have a hierarchy. Of course, we would encourage people for the reasons of health to avoid certain kinds of foods. And then from the point of view of care of others, to avoid killing. And then from the point of view of concern for others, there would be service. And then from the point of view of health, there would be concerns about what you do with sex, because nowadays you can get diseases or you can ruin your most important relationships. In other words, without saying, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, we would be giving the reasons why you should be careful of what you do, because it could ruin what you want. But if somebody were to do something which would be harmful to themselves, we would encourage them to do it better. We would support them to do it better. We would help them understand what's best for them without dictating. It's all free will. And because it's not hierarchical, we don't have buildings and structures to support. So we don't have to get money from you. And we don't have to therefore push you into certain forms of actions or belief or commitments to keep you in line so that you keep giving us money. And we wouldn't mind if you went off to another group whose conception of heaven you like better, or whose way of doing things or whose philosophy felt better for you, because that would be our philosophy, to do whatever is best for you. So if I were to create a religion, it would be like that. So now, if you, anybody, for example, Kamala Mullah's question, which is the whole reason we're discussing this, I think he understands why I'm discussing it like this. It's not that if you pick apart a religion and you pick apart all of the little things that are wrong with it, that makes you somehow superior. No, not at all. Destroying the basis of somebody's visualization is not very good. But to get to the fundamental essence of what that visualization is, the fundamental essence of what that perfection is quite important, because it allows you to create heaven or join together to create heaven in a way which can accommodate everybody. And if you like groups, that's a nice thing to do. But even more horrifying to think of is, what if you think this is all bogus? There is none of this stuff. All there is are chemicals, matter, energy, and nothing more. Hey, fine, then you don't join our group. We can live with that. Anyway, I think it's important for me, especially, not to rip apart structures that actually had great value for me. After all, if I hadn't gone deeply, it's not good for me. I don't like it to rip apart structures that had great value to me in the past. Because, you know, by getting deeply into it, I could understand the essence of things. And I feel that's important to me. Now, whether or not somebody agrees with my conception of essence, that's their right or their, shall we say, task. If they hear what I say and they say I don't agree, it becomes a kind of a task to not agree. That's fine. If somebody therefore says to me, well, I need to defeat you. You are wrong. I'm right. I shall defeat you. You know, I go like, you know, I don't really care. It doesn't matter to me. I mean, that's just, and I don't need to argue and defeat a person back. If what they are doing is what they wish to do, that's fine. A person just wrote to me and said, but they liked chanting Maha Mantra. Hey, I like chanting too. I never said you shouldn't chant. If I told you not to chant, I told you chanting's not important, and you thought chanting was important, the obvious response would be, ah, okay, Hari, that's your opinion. You can say whatever you want. As far as I'm concerned, I like chanting. And I'll go, okay, great. I will never say to you, this is bad. Don't do that. Don't chant. Don't do these things you want to do. What's it to me? What do I care, ultimately? How you do your spiritual practices. I care how I do mine. If you come to me and say, what would you recommend? I would say, well, I recommend like this for you. Because it's something I see as good. We put HariMedia.net out. It's completely voluntary. You like, read it. You don't like, don't read it. You want to hear a lecture? Listen. You don't want to hear? Don't listen. Nobody's forcing anyone to be here on Saturday. Completely voluntary. If you don't listen, and you don't like it, and you think I'm wrong, and you think what I'm doing is terrible, you're not going to go to hell. You're not going to be condemned. You're not even going to have bad dreams at night. It's not going to make bad karma. It's not blasphemy. Now, of course, somebody may say, well, that's because everything you're doing is mental speculation. Obviously, if I don't agree to it, it's not going to harm me. Okay. If that's what you want to believe, fine. I don't think it's my role to pick apart somebody else's belief system to prove that what I'm doing is right. I'm doing what I think is right. If somebody else is doing what they think is right, why should I try to stop them? But while I'm describing what I think is right, if they listen and it twirls their minds around, that's not my fault. I'm not responsible for the effects. If what I say challenges your belief system, first of all, you're the one listening. I didn't force you to listen. And second of all, it challenges you because you feel challenged. It's not because I challenge. It challenges you because you feel challenged. Feel challenged. It's not because I'm challenging you. I'm telling you what I think. If you feel challenged by me, it's because you are challenged. You are challenging yourself. You hear it and say, wait a minute, wait a minute. It can't be this. This can't be so. But that fear that comes is the fact that something I said hit on one of your doubts, hit on one of your fears that you've never allowed yourself to express, to think, or even believe because it would challenge your needs. So, those people, there are many ISKCON people, for example, I forgot who it was, told me that in Germany, they are forbidden to listen to my lectures. Das ist verboten. Now that makes great sense to me. I didn't become insulted. Actually, it was a great compliment. It's a compliment because if what I said was simply mental speculation, nobody would care if anybody heard it. It would just be babble. But because it seems to be intelligent babble, and because it seems to somehow challenge fundamental things, you can't hear it. Now that's fair, because if you don't want to ever be in a situation where you are ever challenged, then don't hear it. Don't hear it. That's good. So if anybody's out there shaking in his boots about what we've discussed today, when you walk out the door and you feel you should do so, absolutely print it on your mind. I will never do this again. I will never come back here again. I will never listen again. And according to what you have as needs, and according to your lack of boldness, oops, I shouldn't say that. According to your needs, you translating? You cannot face this. That's okay. This person just wrote to me and said that they just wanted to learn and to practice to get a result. So they tried visualization, but they can't do it. They can't do the meditation. Their mind is very restless. Therefore, they like to chant. Like to chant. Fine. But why are you telling me this? Are you telling me this because you think what I say is wrong? I don't think so. Or are you telling this because you like to share the fact that, well, you need something else? That's fine. I appreciate it. In any case, I really hope that anything I present here gives everybody the facility to do whatever they want. If you wish to chant, though, it should be done with concentration, because that's the discipline. It should be done by meditating on the sound. The sound. Entering into the sound. Entering into the atmosphere that vibration creates. Riding on the etheric energy of that transcendental sound. You have to, while you're chanting, also visualize the energy of that sound and to enter into it. Because if you simply chant and it's just bouncing off walls, it's not coming into the heart. It really doesn't. It's as equally valuable as the meditation with the restless mind. The chanting is fine as a meditation. Don't forget, it's a meditation. It's a discipline. And it requires the same kind of discipline. The same exact energy of meditative state, concentration, visualization. Why do you think Haridas Thakur sat in one place without moving, chanting? Why do you think as he was chanting verbally, half his rounds or whatever, and then the other half or two-thirds, he was chanting within his mouth and then only in his mind. Why do you think this? Because he was entering into the state of his transcendent world of meditation. Now, if you're running back and forth with your bead bag in your hand, japa talking, when you meet somebody, yeah, 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 I didn't do the pots today, I'm sorry, but I'll get to them. And then you're talking about something or thinking. You're going, you're thinking about this person said this to me and I should have done this and this and that and this and that and this and that and this and that. And you talk about chanting, yet if you listen to the way most people chant, you hardly hear a name of God. I mean, you'll probably hear a lot more Ram, 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 because Ram is easy to say. But Krishna requires work by the mouth. Krishna. It's a tough thing to say. Krishna. It's difficult. From the mouth point of view, Ram, simple. Ram, open it up, spit it out. Ram, easy. Krishna. It's more complex. Therefore, it ends up, hey, Krishna, or ki-ki-ki-ki-ki. Because that becomes easy. It's a one push out of the voice. Kish, kish, kish. Like Ram. Now, do you think that this is the way it should be? I mean, is this according to your practice? Especially when you're walking here and there and you're not really paying attention. And is it really according to your practice? And by the way, you've got these problems called the 10 offenses. That's a tough one. The 10 offenses. Well, let's see. Blaspheming, sadhu ninda. Tough to avoid that one, especially when the sadhus are doing completely idiotic things. But that does it. That'll do it. Committing sinful activities, all those secret things that you don't tell anybody about. Oh my God. All that secret sin. But, well, wait a minute. Which sinful activities? Well, then that means you've got to believe all of these rules. So that means if you're going to have chanting in that tradition, you've got to accept the 10 offenses. One of them is disrespecting the Shastra. So for you who listen, who do wish to be in that, this lecture just destroyed your discipline because you have committed all kinds of offenses in this lecture. You've listened to perhaps sadhunin. You've listened to the being against Shastra things. You've listened to about the sinful activities. I mean, everybody has sinful. Then to maintain attachments. So not only do you have to hear, but you've got to avoid these 10 offenses. Wait, we're not done. You also have to be humbler than a blade of grass. More tolerant than a tree. More tolerant than a tree. That means when somebody comes up and does something to you, you just have to tolerate it. You have to be so humble, never expecting anything for yourself, always giving respect to others. Then you can get to the point where you can do your discipline properly. So if you think meditating is a problem, if you think visualization is a problem, yet you don't think these other things are a problem, okay. In my heaven, you can chant mantras as you like, and you can feel good about chanting those mantras, and you don't have to worry about all this other stuff. But that's just my heaven, and that's all mental speculation. It is. I mean, I'm just saying it. Why should you believe that?